Blog Talk Radio.
This is the EWN Radio Network.
One of the myths I want to dismiss around relationships is that happily ever after means that there's no more fights, there's no more drama, there's no more conflict.
Time for Life Interrupted Radio, a show empowering women to thrive after the unexpected and create a happy, healthy, wealthy life no matter what your circumstance. Here's your host, Sharon Saylor.
Well, welcome to Life Interrupted Radio, and I'm your host, Sharon Saylor, as Wayne just told you. Welcome to the weekend. At least it's my weekend, and I hope it's yours too. I'm here with a cup of hot chamomile and citrus tea, and just excited to have with us Annie Lala. She's an amazing relationship coach that specializes in love, sex, and conflict resolution. And that just about sums up private relationships, doesn't it? Well, she's here with us for the entire hour. And Annie generously agreed to share with us the same tools that her clients pay her a lot of money for, because she is amazing. She can make change happen quickly for people and their relationship. And she has agreed to generously share her practical tools that help her own clients resolve toxic patterns, develop romantic self-esteem, diffuse conflict, get rid of shame and blame, and so we can all cultivate deep, resilient relationships that last a lifetime. Now, who doesn't want that? And the night before Valentine's Day, I'll tell you, it's a perfect time to hear from this expert, Annie Lala, because I know for a fact that relationships and Valentine's Day can cause a lot of conflict. So welcome, Annie. Thanks for being part of Life Interrupted Radio.
Great to be here, Sharon. Delighted.
You are always so transparent in sharing your life stories, and I know you are in a fantastic personal relationship and have a beautiful, beautiful two-year-old daughter. Can you share with us just a little bit of your journey to get to such an amazing, amazing relationship?
Well, yeah, sure, Sharon. First, I want to say it's amazing in that it's an extraordinary crucible for my development and my growth, and I feel deeply loved and committed to in this relationship with my partner. I've been pagan. However, I don't want anyone to get the impression that it's easy or some kind of fairy tale, or that I'm not on the bathroom floor sobbing once in a while because I don't know what to do. Because one of the myths I want to dismiss around relationships is that happily ever after means that there's no more fights, there's no more drama, there's no more conflict. So I'm in a relationship that's extraordinary, not only because I have deep, beautiful, intimate connections with my husband, but also because we have intense, dramatic situations where I'm forced to either lean in and listen to the wisdom behind my husband's frustration or complaint and grow from it, or, you know, dig my heels in and stay stuck to a mediocre old version of myself that is no longer serving me, which is often the choice I have to make. So I just want to be really clear about amazing means to be truly in love means to have equal parts attraction and repulsion. Just like this planet spinning around the sun, for them to stay in their orbit, they have to have tensegrity, a tension between the attraction to the gravity of the sun and the repulsion. If it was too attracted to the sun, they'd spiral into the sun, any planet rotating. If there was too much repulsion, they'd spiral out of orbit. So to keep that beautiful orbit in a relationship, you need to have tensegrity between the tension between the attraction to your partner and the frustration, the drama, the conflict. Anyone who's looking for a relationship or wondering whether theirs is working, just get that those two exist always in true love and to just get used to that. So I just wanted to start with that. It's amazing, but that's what amazing means, okay? And the story, let's see. Literally, I'm 43 years old, and at 38, a love coach, attractive, gregarious, outspoken woman, I still hadn't found my soulmate. And here I was teaching women how to fall in love, how to be in love, how to create relationships. And so there was a bit of a charlatan complex going on for me. Like, you know, who am I to tell people how to be in love when I can't even find a relationship that works? But I knew one thing. I knew one thing that other people weren't talking about, which was a quality and a technology that could create true love, that when I envisioned it, it was a more inspiring version of love than I was reading anywhere else. And I knew I was good at relationships in general, with my parents, with my sister, brother, family, friends. It was a domain that I just had mapped out, and I understood how to connect with human beings. So I thought, okay, I'll teach that. And, you know, they say teach what you want to learn. So I kept teaching how to have amazing romantic relationships until I found one. and it was worth
wonderful.
It. You know, the main sort of rags to riches story I can tell you is at 38, the last relationship I was in before I actually met my soulmate, my current husband, my partner for life, was an extraordinary young man who, Columbia educated, PhD, psychiatrist, brilliant, good looking, smart, amazing. And, you know, within 3 months, we were really deep into a relationship. He'd fallen in love and he was ready to give me marriage, kids, house, like whatever. He was just, I'm in. And at 38, as a woman who really wanted to have children, I noticed myself feeling very attracted to that possibility. Even though there was a nagging feeling in the middle of my body, in my chest, in my soul, that was saying, he's amazing, I love him, but he's not my soulmate. I kept squinting at that and pushing it aside. And it got so far in the relationship that he actually met my family, had found a wedding ring with my sister, and was like just about ready to propose. And some clairvoyant wisdom that was a very complex situation came to me in a dream. I realized that if I actually stayed with this person who was an amazing friend but not my match in life, that something in me that was very important was going to die, which was my commitment to true love. True love as in the highest dance two people can have in terms of intimacy. And gathered up the courage, and I shifted out of that relationship. We're now amazing friends. He's friends with me and my husband now. But the courage it took to say no to basically everything that I could ask for, except that little last bit of he's the one for sure, it gave me an insider access to what it's like to almost sell out. And so a lot of the women I work with as clients are women who they're getting older and they want to have a partner and they want to have a child, and I can smell in them that ability to squint at the part of them that isn't sure about this partner and their willingness to almost sell out. And I want to talk them back off the edge of that cliff, because it's so worth the wait to find your actual soulmate and your partner. And I know it's possible, and it's only possible if a woman actually believes in true love and knows how to attract it. So that's what I've committed my life to working with people on.
I can so resonate with that, because I too have got stories of where I've sold out and 4 years ago found my true love. But the one thing I found, as you mentioned, in finding your true love, there's a lot of times you're called to step up, play a bigger game. Don't allow those old patterns to sabotage yourself. And boy, that sometimes that doesn't feel like true love when all of a sudden you're called to step up and play that bigger game and engage in a deeper, more intimate way.
Yeah, I actually think falling in love equals hiring the smartest, sexiest, most intelligent, conscious version of one of your parents, usually the one that you have the biggest open wound still with, to be stand-in for an old script that you used to have with that wounded parent, the wounded relationship with that parent, and you replay the scenes from your childhood until you get the ending of the script that you want, which is where you get the love that you didn't get from the parent that you always wanted from this partner. Because your new partner that you fall in love with is your new attachment figure, and all your attachment wounds that you have with your parents come up in your romantic relationship. So I see it as like you're hiring someone for the most important job you're ever going to hire for, which is to emancipate you from your old strategies, your obsolete patterns, and call you forward into your highest, greatest self. That's what you're really hiring, falling in love with the person for. You fall in love with not really who they are, so that's part of it. You fall in love with who you get to be around them, who they call you into being by their needs, their wants, their desires for your development. And so a lot, you know, I'd say most of what love is a crucible for self-actualization. And a lot of people don't have that frame. They think love is this comfy, easy, oh, once I find them, everything's going to be okay and I never have to change or grow. But actually, the work starts when you fall in love. Your sleeves get rolled up. And you know, my husband likes to say this, I would quote him all the time, it doesn't take a lot to be in love. It takes everything, because you literally have to die into an us. Your I that you've been cultivating your whole life, which is a magnificent, beautiful, developed persona, has to go through an annihilation where it dies into, like a caterpillar dying into a butterfly, dies into a we, which is the relationship. But what's amazing is when you have the right relationship, the we that you get as you quote-unquote sacrifice your I gives you back a new I, infinitely more magnificent, bigger, profound, and expanded than the one you supposedly had to trade in. But only couples who are actually in true love know this and can report from the other side, who I am now is way bigger than who I was before the relationship, but I had to go through this process of feeling like I was changing and shifting and being sculpted into this new version of myself, when actually what's happening is I was being polished, kind of like David in the block of marble. I was being polished. My magnificence was being polished from a rough-hewn stone that was, you know, hiding under all these defended neuroses and pathologies that we developed when we were young children, trying to deal with growing up in a house where we're trying to get affection and approval from two gods, you know, mom and dad, which shapes our persona. So really, falling in love pulls you into who you really are. It doesn't change you. It scrapes off everything that's not you, which is your fears, myopias, and blind spots.
Absolutely. And when you find that person in your life, I have found that there's so many things driving the relationship. And one of the things in my own personal drive is their acceptance of me as I am and their belief in a higher me, their belief in what my capabilities are. And that belief drives me to even want to continue my growth as a we and my own individual I. And to feel supported in the we. It's this wonderful support system that he offers, emotional support, love and kindness, and is mirroring back when maybe I'm being less than positive.
Yeah, I mean, you fall in love with the person who inspires you the most.
Yes, absolutely.
Hopefully, that's what you're looking for, the person who inspires you the most. Inspires you towards what? Towards your dreams, your growth, your magnificence. And when you talked about, you know, loving you as you are, and at the same time holding a stand for your developed higher self, that seems like a paradox sometimes. When couples are fighting, you know, usually it's about some partner is complaining about something in the other partner, and the other partner is feeling unloved as they are. And there's an interesting technology to circumvent that seeming paradox. And a great example I like to use is my 2-year-old daughter. You know, she started walking at 10 months. And when we watched her in our living room take her first few steps and fumble, like she took 2 steps and then fell to the ground. But what did we do? She wasn't walking perfectly. We didn't boo her or get disappointed. We clapped, we cheered, we celebrated, because those 2 steps, even though they were fumbling, bumbling versions of walking, they were perfect and amazing and exactly where she needed to be in her development as she unfurled as a human being. So we were celebrating where she was right now and the perfection of it and her unfurling development that we knew was coming. And at the same time as seeing as her as perfect and complete and appreciating where she was right now in her development, at the same time we were holding a vision in the future of her walking gracefully, running, not fumbling and bumbling and stumbling. And at the same time we could make how she is now right, not make it wrong or shame her, and still stand for and see a vision of her doing better in the future. So
that's beautiful.
Hear your partner complaining, and one of the things I like to think about is when you hear your partner complaining, if you could search for the commitment lurking behind their complaint, it's usually a commitment to you being more extraordinary or more yourself or more relaxed or more alive. And if you could translate complaints from your partner as fumble, bumbled, I love yous, I see greatness in you. Like, what could that be like? Like, if every complaint was actually a fumbled, I love you, I see you is bigger than this. It's a great reframe.
Oh, I love that. I love that reframe. That can cause a lot of angst in people, though, because our first thing when we hear a complaint, the hackles go up, shall I say. What are some tips for us to keep those hackles down and our heart open to be able to let those complaints come in as the love that's behind them? I see you as greater, and keep our heart open and to our partner when that happens.
Yeah, it's really hard because our first memories of criticism would have been from probably our guardians or our parents, who the most coveted resource was their attention and approval. And so the idea of criticism, just as it hits our system, feels terrifying. So 2 pieces I would add. For the partner who's giving the complaint, if you could always remember, and again, this is just training and practice, that when you give a criticism or feedback or complaint or anything that is suggesting to the person you're talking to that what they're doing could be done better, you have to ramp up the love that you're emanating with your voice tone, your stance, your body language. You have to ramp that up in direct proportion to how intense the feedback is. So the message that your partner should always be getting is, I'm frustrated with you, I'm angry with you, I'm confused, I'm upset, I don't understand this. So the complaint, and I love you more than this anger, more than this frustration, more than this whine about why you left the cap off the toothpaste. If as a romantic partner you were hearing, hey, they're frustrated about something I did, and at the same time, I can smell in their voice and in their behavior and their demeanor, or explicitly, they're saying it, they love me more than their anger or their frustration, I have all the room in the world to hear about their complaint. But what most people do is they withdraw their love consciously or unconsciously so that when they're giving the complaint, the person feels totally alone and disconnected. And my husband and I actually have the words set out like this. I'm really frustrated with you right now. I'm angry. And we give a calibration. I'll say, I'm 7 out of 10 angry with you about this thing you did. However, I love you more than I'm angry. And I usually reach out and touch his hand so he knows we're connected. I love you more than I'm angry, and I'm angry. So once the partner can feel that the love is equal to or stronger than the complaint, you'll notice that your nervous system relaxes and you can hear the commitment behind the complaint or the other person's pain or what's actually, they're complaining about something that's important to them, and really you're not bad and wrong. They're just asking for a change. And probably more often than not, the change they're asking for would make you a more extraordinary person. And that's the question to always ask yourself. Is the thing your partner asking you to become or practice or do, will it make you a more powerful, extraordinary, reliable, respectable person? And if so, why wouldn't you take it on?
You're right, Annie. Why wouldn't we want to take that on? Thank you for sharing that. That's such a transforming way to look at relationships. We need to take a commercial break here, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Life Interrupted Radio will return after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more.
And this hour of Life Interrupted Radio is sponsored by mindfulnessinactionbook.com. Be sure and pop over to mindfulnessinactionbook.com for your free 4-minute meditation. It's a powerful way to reset, regroup, and in only 4 minutes, you can use it anytime, anywhere. So pop over there now and download your MP3 at www.mindfulnessinactionbook.com. Welcome back, everyone, to Life Interrupted Radio. We're here with Annie Lala, relationship expert on love, sex, and conflict resolution. I think that just about sums up what relationships are like. And she's been sharing with us how our partner brings out the best in us and the worst in us, and how that can be the transformational time that we really need to become who we're meant to be. Since we'll take it one step more beyond this idea, I loved you said you reach out and touch your husband's hand during this time and tell him, I love you more than I am angry at this moment. Touch is so important. You have this wonderful concept about conflict. I'll share with the audience some my take on it, because being a body language expert, I was so intrigued by the concept of sitting together on a couch, touching, whether it's a knee or an elbow, not a lot of touch, not a sexual touch, just a touch where you know that they're there. And looking out into the future together. I know you'll describe it better, but what caught me about that was eye contact can be then chosen when to give eye contact about the relationship, and then look out into the future with your eye contact when it could be more anger or more harmful based, and taking that eye contact so each person has a moment to themselves, because eye contact can be so, at times can be so intrusive and aggressive that if we're in conflict. So share with the audience how that's done, because that made such a profound difference in my relationship.
Oh, that's great. Well, eye contact can be used to say, I love you, I'm connected to you. And at the same, in the same act, it can also be used to send an energetic dagger across the space into the other person's eyes, heart, with the contempt look you can get. Eye contact can be an I love you or I hate you or anything in between, right? And so one of the things, the whole body language area that you're an expert in, you'll get why I teach my clients, and I always suggest this to couples that I work with, that you make an agreement with your partner when you're in a good space and a happy space. Hey, when we get in a fight, when we get in a drama, could we agree to have this system where we just have some physical contact, maybe just my hand and your hand touching, or just some small part of our body is connected? Because the nervous system of both animals that are in the conflict, because we're animals, needs to know that it's safe. And if anyone who's ever had a baby that's crying or scared or upset knows, you can't talk a baby down from crying. All you can do is rock it and touch it and soothe it with some kind of physical interaction. And so touch is the first sense we have as human beings, and it's the one that makes us feel safe. And especially if, most couples, when they're in a fight, they don't want to touch the other, again, because they're withholding love to manipulate their partner into changing. When actually it works in the opposite. The more love you give during a conflict, the more the person's likely to shift the behavior. So my husband and I, as soon as someone gets irritated or angry, upset, we reach out and touch the other person just on the leg or the arm, and then we keep listening. So using touch to calm both your nervous system and their nervous system. And then the idea that a conflict is actually not a duel or a fight where it's me against you and there's going to be a winner or a loser, but we're both, I like to see a fight as two arm in arm looking forward into the future, and they're fighting a third entity. Every conflict is a couple is fighting an unknown third entity, which is a misunderstanding. At the root of every conflict is some misunderstanding. There's never usually malintent or malice or an attempt to make your partner feel hurt or crazy. But we think there is. But if you dig deep into the understanding instead of attacking each other, you'll find there's going to be an aha moment where you're like, oh, that's how you interpreted that? Oh, that's what you thought I meant? Well, actually, it was this. And then instead of it going into an antagonistic space, it goes into deeper intimacy and understanding of each other. So the fight ends up being an access to more connection and more understanding instead of pushing you further away. And in terms of eye contact, use your intuition around whether your eye contact is enhancing intimacy or intruding on it. And you know personally if you're using a gaze to share affection or acceptance or to attack. But this is underneath all the words. And I would encourage you to recognize that any eye contact, eyes really are windows into the soul. And so when you're making that eye contact with that person and you're sending a dagger or an I hate you or I can't stand you across the space, it's causing a wound, and it takes a long time to heal that wound. And if you actually intend to keep building the relationship with this person, you don't want to put that wound in the space that you then have to clean up later.
Oh, and it's true. The eye contact is one of those wounds that oftentimes we're not aware of. With yours and my training, we're aware of it. But oftentimes other people are like, well, that's not what I meant. Or what are you talking about? I didn't say anything. Well, that eye contact sent a much deeper, more hurtful message than anything that sometimes the words can say. I love to share this opportunity when we're doing the resolution is actually sitting side by side and using my hand gestures into the future. And so my hand gestures are out and away from both of us and sharing, what are we going to do about this? I'm not abandoning you, and that's so important. So I'm glad you shared that with the audience.
Yeah, and if you're sitting on the couch beside them, you can still be touching, legs or shoulders. So there's still a connection, even though there's no eye contact in that moment.
If we want to get into the science of it, it's all about that vagus nerve, that very rudimentary beginning nerve of all human beings needing safety, that every human being needs to know safe, that they are safe before they can have any growth or any movement, and making sure that I feel safe and my partner feels safe is absolutely critical. I want to circle back to this idea of the original blog post I read over at annielala.com, and she's just always got amazing blog posts there and tremendous articles. I encourage you all to go over there and enjoy her site and get a hold of Annie, because she's just a wealth of knowledge. I want to circle back around and talk about this idea of should I stay or should I go? And when that enters our mind, what is that really telling us when all of a sudden maybe we thought we were happy and I don't want to say all of a sudden, but maybe it's like a moment where we all of a sudden that pops through our mind. What's that about?
Well, first I want to say, you know, I work with couples. There's a few couples I know that are actually in love. And I've never met a couple, including the ones in love, that haven't gone through some moment of exasperation or desperation where they've entertained the thought, what the hell am I doing here? I'm in the right relationship. Should I stay or should I go? Even I've been there. Okay. The difference between couples who stay and couples who go is when those thoughts come up, usually they're not long-lived. They're usually in the heat of the moment, and they usually dissipate very quickly. And in moments when the couples are connected, that thought is the farthest thing away from them. It's when you're in a relationship where that thought's kind of there all the time, even when things are going well, that, you know, I would suspect it's a deeper mismatch going on. But in terms of trying to really look at why that thought comes up, fleeing, you know, they say fight or flight, your amygdala response, fight or flight. So flight is what we do when we feel unsafe. We want to escape. And from the perspective that I mentioned earlier, where a part of your defended ego persona has to die into an ushood to produce a relationship, which then later gives you back a less defended ego, okay? But the part of you that's identified with your defended ego is going to feel unsafe as it enters a relationship and the person starts standing for your magnificence, your greatness, your dreams becoming more extraordinary. The defended ego is going to feel like it's unsafe, and it's right. It is unsafe. Your undeveloped old neurotic patterns are very unsafe in relationship that is true love, because that partner of yours is going to stand for your greatness, and anything that's less than magnificent, they're going to help lovingly, hopefully, and compassionately, hopefully, scrape away that to show your shimmer and to polish you into the magnificent art piece that you are.
Now, what's so interesting about that, Annie, is this idea of unsafe. I was thinking about, you know, sometimes when people call us to be greater, calling us out on our stuff, calling us to say, like, you know, what's that about? Or, you can do it. I know you can do it. That part of us you were talking about, the old self or the defended ego, that's the fight or flight part. It's having to drop that old ego of us, and we're feeling unsafe because we're being pushed into the unknown, even though we know it's for our greatness or our betterness, or we can say that our partner is right. You know, you're so right. I should take that job. I should take that promotion. You are so right. But having to let go of what we maybe doesn't serve us, but we are comfortable in what we think is safe, mm-hmm. into the unsafe can be so uncomfortable to be. So I love this idea about safety and unsafe, and should I stay or should I go, oftentimes isn't about our partner. It's about this idea of being comfortable in stuff that isn't serving us anymore because we feel safe, because we know how to react.
You know, ultimately, it's, you know, what I've learned as a mother going through building a human being in my body, I've learned that becoming an adult is about taking radical responsibility for my own emotional state at all times. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't get it right all the time, but I've got the epiphany that it's up to me to make sure that my nervous system is relaxed and calm, because another little human being depends on it now. Not only when she was inside me, but for the first year, a child has no self-regulation in their nervous system. The only way they know how to soothe their nervous system when they're stressed or overwhelmed is by entraining with their mother. So my child's safety depends on my inner safety. I have to actually feel safe on the inside. So I have to learn to feel safe when I'm scared, when I'm upset, when I'm angry at my husband. So I've realized what continues from that is radical adulthood is taking responsibility for your own safety as well, which means in the middle of your partner frustrated with you, upset, you're going to feel triggered in the way that you were when you were younger with your parents. And in that moment, mm-hmm. and there's lots of research around how to do this, it's your job to learn how to go inside, use breathing exercises, visualization exercises, talk to your little girl inside, ask her what she needs, rock her into soft, relaxed space, whatever you need to do to take responsibility for the scared little girl inside you. It's actually your job as a woman to make your little girl inside safe first, not your partner's. And this is where most couples get it wrong. We automatically believe it's our partner's job to make us feel safe, to rescue us when we're outside of our emotional comfort zone, and to make us feel happy. And actually, all of that is up to us. And becoming an adult is when you get that epiphany.
I am so glad you brought that up. So many times, as an executive coach and a business coach with professional women myself, it comes up even in their professional lives where we're talking about this isn't somebody else's job. This is your job. You're no longer a little girl. Are you unsafe? And oftentimes, more than not, we'll say 99% of the time, it is an emotional response where they are safe. They just need to take a deep breath, step back, reevaluate the situation, and realize they have all of the training, all of the knowledge that they need in that moment, even if that knowledge is to go find a mentor, go find a coach, go find someone to ask those questions of. But they have everything they need. It's very rare that, you know, a saber-toothed tiger is chasing us and making us physically unsafe these days. And I do know there are situations where, you know, we can be physically unsafe, and I don't mean to minimize that. However, in the context of our talk today, we are in a loving relationship, and our safety, our physical safety, isn't what's being compromised. It's that emotional little girl, ego, whatever, is being bruised. And sometimes I dig my heels in and, you know, like, no way, no how. But I know that that's the little girl who's just having a temper tantrum, and it's time to take a deep breath.
I do want to clarify that the unsafe feeling that people feel is real, saber-tooth tiger or not. If they're about to go into a boardroom talk with their boss, the terror they feel in their heart is real. And the reason it's real is because they've regressed from their current grown-up woman resourceful nervous system down to a younger age. But they don't realize they've regressed. And so the little girl in the back seat has come to the front of the car and is driving now. The only way to get that little girl out of driving the car and put her back in her car seat is to make her feel safe. And every woman has to learn technologies, which I teach, to go inside and reparent that little girl till she feels safe. You can't skip that step.
And we need to take a commercial break here. We'll be back in a moment where we're sharing with Annie Lala on relationships, conflict, conflict resolution, and right now sharing this idea of am I safe or am I unsafe and how true that feeling can be to us.
Life Interrupted Radio will be back after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more.
And this hour of Life Interrupted Radio is sponsored by mindfulnessinactionbook.com. Be sure and pop over to mindfulnessinactionbook.com for your free 4-minute meditation. It's a powerful way to reset, regroup, and in only 4 minutes, you can use it anytime, anywhere. So pop over there now and download your MP3 at www.mindfulnessinactionbook.com. You're connected. Well, welcome back to Life Interrupted Radio. We're here with Annie Lala. And this last few minutes, we've been talking about the idea of, am I safe? Am I unsafe? And that little girl inside of us that asked that question and how we can help her come to her full adulthood and have a loving relationship. So welcome back, Annie. Let's get into this idea of safe and unsafe and the little girl again.
And the first time we felt unsafe, it was real. We were probably 3 or 4 and someone was yelling or someone got angry and our nervous system was on red alert because when you were young, if someone didn't love you or cared about you, you could die. So every time we feel nervous to talk to a colleague at work, the feeling inside is on pain of death because it links back to that original terror. So the grown-up, wise, maternal part of you needs to come forward and go inside and find the terror in that little girl inside you and know what to do to calm her down. Because if you don't know what to do to help her, you will never know what to do to help your actual child in the real world or your partner when you fall in love when they're unsafe. You have to start home first, feel safe here, and then you can give safety to someone else.
Oh, I'm so glad you clarified that for the audience and brought that to our attention because it's so critically important. What are some of the first steps when we feel that terror going through us?
I have three ninja moves that literally I hang my life on. And they're techniques that people use for trauma patients who struggle with intense panic attacks and anxiety. So if it can work for them, it can definitely work for the rest of us. I'll give you my three top tools. And everyone can find their own, you know, yoga, breathing, Vipassana. But the fastest way I found is to start with closing your eyes and taking three deep breaths where the exhale is twice as long as the inhale.
Mm-hmm.
And it forces you to regulate your breathing, making the exhale twice as long. I sometimes do between three and five breaths, but three minimum. The second tool, I close my eyes. I make a dot in the middle of my head, 3-4 inches behind my forehead, in the middle of my brain. Then I make a dot down in my belly, 3-4 inches behind my belly button, behind my dantian. Then I draw a straight line between those two dots. After I do my breath, I close my eyes. I bring all my consciousness, attention, awareness, and will to the top dot, and I move down the midline. It's called the midline. I move down the midline to the dot in my belly. Then I turn around and go back up, and I do this 9 times minimum. And the trick is with the midline is you move along the line at whatever pace you need to go in order to stay on the line. If your mind starts wandering or you get distracted, it means you need to move a little faster. It doesn't matter how fast you move. You do 9 midline up and down. This gets you into your soma, into your body, and out of your narratives. It's the fastest way that I know. There are other ways, absolutely. But those two techniques pretty much can get me out of 80% of my terror, scared, overwhelmed, angry situations where I need to calm down and regulate my nervous system. The third technique I use, which is my like only break in case of emergency behind the glass technique, is when shit gets really hectic, I usually do this alone, is I go find a space in my apartment, or sometimes I've done it in the middle of the street on the sidewalk if I have to. I squat on the ground, 2 feet flat on the ground, squat like a frog. And I put my hands, the palms, flat on the ground between my legs, between my two knees. So all four of my limbs are flat on the ground. And if I can do it on earth, I do it on earth. And then I close my eyes. And this is after I've done the three breaths in the midline. This is like the third one. Then I close my eyes and I imagine roots coming out of my ovaries and my uterus and my whole reproductive feminine system, and going down through the concrete, through the grass, through the earth, down, 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 past all the rocks and the roots of the trees, down past anything, water wells. I use my imagination to imagine what these roots from my system are going to be passing until it gets to the center of the earth. And I wrap these roots around the center of the earth till it's tight. And then I keep my eyes closed, and then I suddenly imagine the cosmos. And there's the sun and all the planets rotating around the sun, and there's Earth. And I look at Earth and I see there's Annie squatting on the Earth with her roots straight into the middle of the planet wrapped around the center. She is not falling off. She is safe. And then I close the visualization. When I use those three in that order, nothing. I can come back from being in the middle of like the most terrifying situation. When I use them three in together, that is how I take radical responsibility for regulating my nervous system, coming back to safety, coming back to the present moment, and being there for the people I love.
Those are three amazing ways, and I love that the first two absolutely you can do anywhere, anytime, without anyone actually being consciously aware that you're doing them.
Yeah.
The third one might be a little more obvious.
Yep.
But I love that idea. As you were talking, sharing with the audience how to do it, I could feel myself, even though I'm not in a squatting position here in the studio, I could still begin to feel those roots as you were sharing with how that is done. I could begin to feel myself just get grounded in that moment. Now, how powerful this idea of squatting and actually doing the whole visualization.
Great. Well, I hope people try it. I mean, it's great to just hear it and go, that's cute. But I'm telling you, if there's nothing anyone takes from this conversation, but those three tools, and they just practice it once in a while, like even if they're just 4 out of 10 irritated by someone driving too slow in front of them, they're at a red light, whatever, close your eyes, take the three breaths, just notice the shift in your nervous system. the actual testing of it is what will have you convinced that it's a useful tool.
Oh, I'm an advocate of breathing. In my nonverbal work, that is the number one misunderstood nonverbal. People don't understand that the first impression people have of you is, how are you breathing when you walk into the room? Are you breathing high and shallow and rapid? That sets off the unconscious fight or flight in other people. Mm-hmm. And this ability just to stop, close your eyes for a moment, take some nice, deep, cleansing breaths. And I love that you share this idea of the exhale has to be twice as long as the inhale, because the exhale is where we relax.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the body relaxes. The inhale actually takes energy, and the exhale is where we relax. And the 3 to 5 breaths, it can be so cleansing. Even if we're not in an extremely stressful situation, I found just the slightest bit of stress, how much breathing, consciously aware of our breathing, can shift how we're feeling in the moment. And the idea of midline, the dot in the brain down to the midline, I enjoyed that is an excellent way also to get centered and connect the emotional part of our body to our brain and make sure that that connection is free-flowing so we have all of the information at hand that we need right away. I love that you call them ninja moves.
Well, my husband, literally, if things get intense, like he sees me getting frazzly or overwhelmed, he just holds my hand and says, take your breath and find your midline. And he reminds me to go take responsibility for my emotional state instead of rescuing me by trying to fix the situation. He sees me as big and capable and not a damsel in distress that needs to be rescued, which is better for him and better for me in terms of our development. A part of me wants him to just fix it and rescue it and make me feel better, but the bigger part of me wants him to stand for my ability to rescue myself, which will make me a much better mother, wife, human being.
Thrilled that you brought that up, because I think for at least from my generation, I know I'm a couple of generations ahead of you, but this idea, well, I was brought up on the fairy tale, you know, where they lived happily ever after once you met Prince Charming, and this idea of rescue me is often ingrained in many, many women. It takes a lot of courage to have that ability to verbalize and be emotionally available, each partner be emotionally available to themselves and to their partner, that they don't feel responsible to rescue each other.
Yeah, and the thing I want to point out is what's fascinating is as soon as I learned to rescue myself into safety with those 3 tools, as soon as I took responsibility and I learned he's not coming to save me, I'm going to learn to do it myself, what magical thing happened is he started wanting to save me all the time. And what's interesting is when the man or the woman, when the partner doesn't have to save you because they know you can do it, it is a pleasure, a delight, and a gift to then help support you and save you when you're distressed. When they think you can't do it and you're dependent on them, that's when some deep part of them knows and gets frustrated at enabling you to stay in your smallness. So as soon as I learned to do it and I didn't need him, he'd be like crawling up next to me, trying to hug me, trying to soothe me. What I always wanted before that he wasn't doing. But now that I knew how to do it for myself, he's so happy to do it. So it's a funny counterintuitive outcome. But the more you don't need your partner to save you, the more they clamber up trying to save you.
I have that in my own relationship, and I'm glad you bring that up because it is counterintuitive. And the more that we can verbalize what's going on for us, one time not too long ago, my partner wanted to discuss something in I wanted to discuss it too, but at the moment I had been going through a lot of things and I just took the time to say, look, you know, honey, I understand. I'm feeling quite emotionally fragile right now. Can we talk about this tomorrow morning? And I gave a time. And as long as he was perfectly fine with that, he accepted it, understood that, and thanked me that I was willing to talk about it. And actually, we set a date and time, so it wasn't like I was just, can we talk about this later? And then later never come.
Right.
But the ability to both save ourselves, but also then verbalize what's going on for us, both partners, is so critically important. But I also find it takes a lot of soul searching and a willingness to be vulnerable and transparent.
Yeah. Honesty. I don't even like to use the word vulnerable, because when people are young, they don't grow up and say, I want to be vulnerable when I grow up. But everybody wants to grow up and be honest.
Point.
And I see honesty. Vulnerability is just a subset of honesty. So to make transparent what's true for you is honesty. And no one can know you so that they can love you unless you make yourself transparent. You know, into me see is actually what intimacy is. And so, yeah, reporting your actual feelings in real time is an art form that I'm still practicing. We love doing calibrations. So, hey, honey, I'm feeling emotionally fragile right now. My period just started, and I know you want to talk through something. I'm at like 7 out of 10 kind of uneasy. Could you be a little more sensitive with me today, or could we talk about it in a week? Any man would love to handle that because he knows where you're coming from. But a lot of times women just expect the man to know, and to know that you're at an 8 out of 10 overwhelm when he can't. He doesn't know if you're angry like 3 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 unless you tell him. And you could teach him, calibrate by calibrating yourself, and then over time they can start to feel it out for themselves. But most men don't know. They can't really tell that you're upset until you're literally crying or bleeding out, you know, your eyeballs.
Well, we say most men don't know, but I think a lot of women don't have that technique down either, being able to see the frustration in their partner until the frustration is boiling out the ears. It's a willingness to be open to each other and learn from each other that I think your message is so powerful about, giving us these tips and techniques to be open and transparent and honest with each other. But that first comes with being honest with ourselves, and oftentimes we'll talk ourselves out of it. Oh, I just took that wrong, or that didn't really happen to me. Even if maybe it's nothing our partner said, maybe it's something that happened at work that day that we bring home. And
it usually is, actually. It's usually never about your partner. It's usually about some issue you're having that you've had since you were 4 and you're projecting onto them. But the partner triggers it. The thing I didn't mention earlier that I do want to make sure we get in is, since we're talking about the work it takes to be in love and stay in a relationship and the development and the muscle building, I see the relationship as a dojo or a gymnasium to build your developed emotional muscles. The thing that I didn't mention is, when you find the right partner, when you actually find a partner that you are in true love with, that's the only force strong enough to keep you in the game with your sleeves rolled up in the development game, when everything in you says run.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the way you know you're in love, actually, is that you can't run. You might want to run, you might consider running, you might think about it, but you can't, because on some deep, sacred level in your soul, you know this person was made for you. This is your access and your portal to greatness, and they can love you better than anyone else, even though they're imperfect. And that you can love them better than anyone else, even though you're imperfect. And when that truth is present, you can't run. It's this exquisite trap, true love, that keeps you working on your stuff, because who they are is still way more than the pain, headache, heartache that relationship brings with it. So you have to find the person who being with them and in that relationship is more valuable to you than running from the work. That's what I call true love.
And I so agree with that, that now that I have that in my life, but I'm reflecting back and thinking on the times where I thought it was true love, but until now, when I'm in that same state that you just described, I'm not sure I could have understood that concept from the previous frame, from the previous me.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be going, what are you talking about? I couldn't run. I'm not sure I could have understood that frame until being here and reflecting back, going, yes, oh, Annie, I so agree. That is exactly where I'm at right now.
It's kind of, you know, for anyone who has a child, you know, I don't know, probably a lot of the women listening might, you know, have a child. And they know those moments in life where everything in them doesn't want to engage with the child. They are busy, they're stressed, they're frustrated. Like, they haven't stopped caring that the child's alive and safe, but in that moment, they're not happy with the child, the situation, with motherhood even in that moment. And every mother knows they hit those moments. But at no moment in time does the anger, the frustration, or the exasperation take you to, I'm leaving. I'm going to dump my child on the street. You know, that's it. They were too bad. They were too mischievous today. That's it. I'm taking them to the orphanage. There's something in the mother in you that goes, no matter how crazy and how hectic this is, I'm going to make sure they get fed and they sleep and they survive this lifetime.
Exactly.
And you stay committed. And it's that, it's for someone who hasn't tasted true love yet, but if they have a child, that's the closest I can give you as a sample. There's no, oh, I'm going to just give up. I'm done with motherhood now.
That's a great way to reframe that so people can look out of that and say, yes, okay, now I have some way to put a frame around it so I know what I'm looking for. And we have just a couple of minutes left. I love your knowledge, wealth of knowledge, and I know we could just talk on and on, but we just have a couple of minutes left. If I can take us to just a little field for a moment, and what are a couple of the things that let us know if we're still looking for true love? What are some things that we should be doing with ourselves, for ourselves, to prepare ourselves to find this person?
Yeah, okay, I have one main tip. Basically, most women are looking for a guy that matches a certain set of criteria. If he's this amazing at this, then he can do this for me, and he can make this for me, make me feel this. Most women aren't focused on being the most extraordinary wife, partner, girlfriend to that future soulmate that they're looking for. They're busy looking for the best soulmate for them. It's backwards. When, if you want to marry or date or become partners with the most amazing man that you can find, you have to be the most amazing woman he's ever seen, met, or heard of. So until you believe you're her, you will not find him. So the fastest way to get your guy or to get attract your mate is counterintuitively to not even go looking, but to surround yourself with resources, books, workshops, coaches, support, friends, education, to cultivate in yourself all the areas where you know you're underdeveloped, whatever they are. Become the kind of woman that you would put beside the most extraordinary man you'll ever meet. Become her. And as in that process of you becoming her, he will find you. He will find you.
Beautiful. What a lovely parting thought here. Now, Annie, I want everyone to know how to get in contact with you. And please share your website so people have an opportunity to learn more about you and read your fantastic blog. And you have a wonderful love test that I want people to take.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people are confused about love. When they're in the relationship, they're like, am I in love? Is he in love with me? They are not quite clear. So I put a lot of intentionality into coming down to 10 questions in a love test. It's not a cheesy Cosmo love test. You know, this, all my years of intelligence and imagination and wisdom has been distilled into these 10 questions. And I really believe if you take this love test and you answer these 10 questions, you'll know whether you're in love with the person you're with or whether they're in love with you. So there's a test for a man and a test for a woman. And there's some similar questions, but if you take this love test, you'll basically be able to know, should I stay or should I go? Is this relationship serving my greatness? Is it my access to actualization and my highest self and my dreams? And it's what you get as a free gift when you go visit my website and you just opt in to my newsletter. We just take your name and your email. Right away, you'll get it sent to you, the love test. You'll also get an essay where I describe a lot of the ideas I mentioned today. What is true love? How to fight? How to transcend shame? It's like a 10-page essay on my best ideas, and you get that as a free gift, that report. Just to take a look on my website, my husband, one of his mottos is move the free line. So give away as much free as you can so people get your ideas. So on my website, it's got videos that teach you about fighting. It has videos of me and my husband fighting on stage. I have free teleclasses and seminars that are transcribed. Everything that I could possibly give you free is there, so just have a look around and see what resonates, and take the tools and try them in your life.
Oh, and the tools do work. I have followed Annie for some time now, and I just am always amazed at her insight and wisdom. I want to spell your, how about spelling your name so everybody knows how Annie Lala, I know it's kind of how it sounds, but spell it out so people know what your URL is.
Yep, I'm at www.annielala.com. Annie with two N's, Lala with two L's. So annielala.com. And I'd love to have you on my in my tribe. I'm starting a new podcast series. It's free. I'm starting a new video series where I answer client questions for 5 minutes every week. It's launching in the next month. So sign up and you'll get all this amazing, my cutting edge ideas and insights. I just want to share them with the world, because my mission is that everybody finds their soulmate and falls in love. It's possible for everyone, no matter how old you are, no matter what's gone in your life, divorce, children, it's possible. But it starts with you believing that it's possible and learning the skills to attract it. And that's what I've dedicated my life to.
And you are fabulous at it, my dear. Just absolutely. I've been a fan of yours for ages here and enjoy supporting getting this message out to the world. I also want to put a little note out there that a lot of what Annie shares will work in your professional life as well. Learning all about yourself, the deep trueness of yourself, who you are, where you are, understanding conflict. Perhaps maybe you are in the ideal relationship right now and you're just hearing Annie's talk right now with us. Understand that all of this works in your professional life as well. It's not just in finding your soulmate, because all of her stuff is fabulous. So Annie, thank you for joining me on Life Interrupted Radio. This has just been an amazing opportunity for my audience to grow and step into who they're meant to be. So thank you for sharing your wisdom with us today.
You're so welcome. Enjoy your day. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Life Interrupted Radio. To learn more, listen to other shows, and gain free resources that can help empower your life, be sure to stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.